Well, is George Orwell's 1984 coming true, with more and more Americans being debanked, flocking cameras everywhere, people being shut down online simply for their speech? What is happening to the surveillance state in the United States of America? Is it already too far gone for us to do anything about it? Well, someone who knows about this deeply was the man who tried to warn all of us about the warrantless wiretapping of Americans before Edward Snowden was the story. Thomas Drake was the story, a decorated veteran of the United States Air Force, the United States Navy, and an NSA whistleblower who went through the proper channels to try to stop what was happening to the American people and exposed the government's illegal spying on Americans. And so we wanted to have a deep dive conversation today about what is happening in the United States of America and to the American people, and is it too far gone? Thomas, thank you so much for joining us here on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So before we get into maybe the current state of affairs, where things are going in the United States with flocking cameras and debanking, I think people don't even know the level of the debanking that's happening in the U.S. right now. But maybe you could maybe walk people through your story. And, you know, people have heard about Edward Snowden, of course, and what happened to him. You, though, tried to go through the proper channels to try to warn the powers that be about this warrantless wiretapping, and maybe kind of start at the beginning and how you got involved with this.
Well, it's quite a story. It goes back now several decades in terms of its origins, because I grew up in the 1970s as a very young teenager, during a period in which a lot of scandals came out, a lot of investigations, church pipe committee hearings, revealing just how far the government had gone in violating the rights of Americans in secret. And there was a number of laws that were put into effect after that, reform laws, to sort of stem the tide of what I will sort of was the early days of the surveillance state as it began to emerge. And then, you know, that was the analog era of information. But the government had gone quite far. And anybody can, you know, do Daniel Ellsberg, you know, in terms of the bright and shining light of Vietnam, a president resigned their office because, in fact, he was engaging in criminal acts. He was even using the intelligence agencies to go after his, you know, enemies. I became very sensitized. I mean, I have to admit that was my civic awakening, and I never forgot that. You know, little did I, you know, imagine that, you know, some barely three decades later that I would be faced with distinct prospect that my government was going to go off the rails and just say, hey, the Constitution's in the way, for a lot of some justifiable reasons, but in many of them were just simply the excuse of not having to follow the law or exercise options that were in fact lawful. So to say it, you know, just to sort of summarize, and there I went in the military. So one of the things in the military, because I was in the reconnaissance, the signals intelligence collection and analysis business, flying as an air crew member, as a crypto linguist, voice processing specialist, listening in on adversaries of the United States and other areas of interest around the world, we were absolutely forbidden, with very narrowly scoped exceptions. We could not listen in on what was called U.S. person. So a U.S. person would be someone, you know, born in America, or a legal resident of America. And that could be whether it was domestic or overseas, by the way. And interestingly enough, US corporations, there was very specific restrictions with criminal penalties. And this was all under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that was updated since it went into effect under the Carter administration 78, five times, just to keep up with the times in terms of technology. It wasn't the case, as was later when they tried to justify, you know, violating the FISA and the Fourth Amendment. It was out of date and couldn't keep up. That is not true at all. However, let's move forward. So I ended up, long story short, I ended up becoming a senior executive at the NSA, and my first day on the job was 9/11. Still a rather dramatic event, not just in my life, but people that were at least, old enough to remember, there's sort of life before 9/11, and then there's life after 9/11. That certainly is a date. I was 44 years of age at the time. It's hard to believe it's 25 years ago almost. And very quickly after 9/11, the government decided that it just needed to start, because of the failure to keep 3,000 people, almost 3,000 people who were murdered that day, despite all the warnings, despite all the intelligence, and that's a whole story in itself. And despite the fact that there was means by which you could have both, you did not have to sacrifice liberty for security, you didn't have to sacrifice security for liberty, something that Benjamin Franklin had something to say about that some years ago. Because you might lose both, right? If you try to sacrifice either. You can actually have both. It's not an either-or case. It's not one of those cases where you have to draw a line. But what happened after 9/11 really became the foundation for my whistleblowing at NSA. Because what happened is they decided in the deepest of secrecy, and we're talking about one of the deepest deep state secrets of all time. It was even deeper than the torture program, enhanced interrogation techniques, haha, euphemism, again, Orwellian language. They decided to engage in what they referred to as bulk collection. That's their euphemism, Orwellian language, rather than call it mass surveillance, because that has a different, I mean, it has a much starker meaning, decided to start collecting massive amounts of data without any warrants on Americans. And I was confronted within just weeks of 9/11. It was my moment of truth. I remember confronting my supervisor, who's the number three person at NSA at the time. I remember going to the general counsel's office saying, "What are we doing? We're violating the Constitution." And you just basically being told, "You don't understand, Mr. Drake. We just need the data." And I'm saying, "Well, we're in violation. If you're saying that the laws cannot keep up with the times in terms of the threat, go to Congress and change the law, modify the law. That's the mechanism in a constitutional republic by which you do that." And he said, "Well, if we do that, they're going to say no." And that's when the hair like stood up on the back of my neck, and I said, "We're going way, we're blasting right through the guardrails." And so I knew I could not remain silent. I knew that if I did not say anything, that I would be basically supporting the subversion of the Constitution. And you have to remember, I had taken an oath a number of times during my government military career, three times in the military, once at CIA, and now fifth time I'm taking the oath to support and defend the Constitution. And I would not violate my oath. I was going to maintain absolute fidelity to that oath, the law of the land, literally the law of the land, and that no one, no agency, no person, no president was ever above the law. And here in secret, we're going to violate it because of a national security exemption, this massive exemption that was being applied. So the vast power of NSA was quickly turned to spy on America. And what it began doing was sweeping up, or in partnership with certain telecommunication concerns and others, sweeping up vast volumes of American phone calls, text messages, emails, and it just grew by leaps and bounds from there. Of course, Congress, I mean, this is history, but Congress realizing, wait a minute, this whole intelligence apparatus that had been put into place, in the years after World War II was supposed to keep us from any electronic surprise, right? A la Pearl Harbor. And here it utterly failed, despite all the indications, despite all the warnings. So I began to blow the whistle, and I also became a material witness for several investigations, two congressional 9/11 investigations, and also a DOD inspector general investigation. And I recognize, going back, because these are all the channels that are available to one as a whistleblower. If you see something, say something, to use that phrase in a different context, I'm seeing my own government. The problem is that the whistleblower channels are monitored and controlled by, secret power, or influenced by secret power. And the last thing you're going to do, especially when the decision to turn NSA's enormous power on its own country, there's no way you're going to be able to blow the whistle and, not get blowback. And I certainly began to receive significant retaliation, retribution for even having cooperated with these investigations, even though, like with Congress, it was under, I was subpoenaed. I was, I remember going down to this was during the joint inquiry, where I went down to a nondescript building that they had turned into a SCIF, and there I am, saying I'm gonna, speak nothing but the truth, right?
So you were subpoenaed by Congress.
I
So
was subpoenaed. There was
you should have
official
had
investigation.
whistleblower protection and
Well,
secrecy.
yeah, but if there's a right, yeah, I had rights as a whistleblower, but there's no remedy if they decide to violate that. Then what is it? It's a paper tiger. So I was a great risk early on. I mean, we're talking right after 9/11. I was already marked as someone they couldn't control. In fact, during the time I was cooperating the initial 9/11 investigation, out of Congress, it was one of the subcommittees for the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, which turned into the Joint Inquiry, a much larger investigation. Again, this is prior to the 9/11 Commission, which, again, President Bush and Vice President Cheney severely objected to. They really did not want, any kind of commission looking into why we had failed to protect the nation, which was, that's the job, right? I mean, that's one of the two primary responsibilities of government. If you go back to the preamble, and I keep referencing the Constitution. That's the thing that's supposed to make us, even though it has its own faults and its own foibles and a lot of things where, cans were kicked down the road in terms of sort of the sins of the nation, original sins. It is the law of the land, and it was an attempt to govern differently, based on sort of the base human condition, as I call it. And remember, the first Constitution didn't even have any Bill of Rights or an amendment. That came a couple of years later, because it's, how we as a people, we the people, right? So there, in the preamble, it talks about, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare. Well, yeah, the general welfare and the common defense are the two primary responsibilities. So the failure to provide for the common defense led to these investigations. So yes, I was subpoenaed, and I am providing material evidence regarding what NSA knew, should have known, could have known. And also, and this is the thing that was even worse, sort of like under, again, throwback to what happened during the Nixon administration, the cover-up became worse than the crime, and put that crime in quotes. There was a massive cover-up about what NSA actually knew or should have known regarding 9/11, especially NSA. It was a systemic failure. That's clear. And that's a whole story, in itself, that unfolded over a number of years. But even George Tenet, at the time, the director of Central Intelligence, the director of the CIA, he knew the system was blinking red. He had sent out a memo 3 years prior to 9/11 with that exact phrase. I remember reading the memo when I was a contractor at NSA, but it was all like blown off. No one really, it's like, who cares? So,
What did you show
here,
them on the wiretapping? What you were seeing?
well,
How
it
did
was,
you describe it to Congress? How did you describe it in your testimony?
in very stark terms, that equipment was being placed on U.S. networks for the purpose of blanket surveillance, and
By the
it
NSA.
just by the NSA, and in partnership and in cooperation with telecommunication concerns, but incredibly a compartmented level, secret. So, we're talking, in terms of classification levels, with some of the key phone companies and others in the United States, and that just kept growing over the years. I also, so there was the actual evidence of them placing or instrumenting U.S. networks for the purpose of blanket surveillance. No warrants.
We'll get back to the show in a second, but first, I have a little bit of a quiz for you. It's really short, but it could change your life. You've heard us report on this show, of course, that the U.S. dollar is losing value daily. Our national debt is out of control, and you can bet no one in Washington or Wall Street cares at all about your financial freedom and how you could maybe build passive income in your life. They don't care. They're not going to make money off of it. That's the policy. That's why you and only you need to become financially independent. It's time to break free from this system. And when I learned this years ago, I mean, I was a victim of this, or I shouldn't say a victim, but I was really stupid with money, really stupid, and went massively into debt. I didn't understand how the system worked. And it wasn't until I really got smart and figured things out financially that I was able to break free of this cycle. And it can happen very quickly if you understand how the system works. So if you're wondering, there is a method. It's been proven time and time again. And it's through real estate. Real estate has created more millionaires than any other investment type in history. And it's exactly how Natalie and I were able to break free of this cycle. Heck, I was working at Fox News at the time, and I literally couldn't pay my mortgage. Like, I wasn't bringing in enough money to cover my mortgage and the two kids that I had at the time. It was really difficult. So I had to break this cycle, had to become independent on a boss and the stock market or whatever nonsense like Washington sends your way. So I figured out that I could do that, and I broke free, and you can do the same thing. Honestly, you can do it. If a guy as dumb as me can do it, you can certainly do it. Your path will probably look different from ours, and figuring out your next steps can actually be pretty tricky, especially if you're just getting started, but that's okay. So we built a 60-second quiz. It's that short, 60 seconds, that shows you exactly where you are and where you stand as an investor. Maybe you're really advanced. Great. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're middle of the road. But it gives you a clear, simple next step for moving forward. So right now, stop wishing you had a portfolio of performing assets. Take action. Start building one today. Right now, all you need to do is go to our website, redacted.inc/quiz, and you can take it while you're watching the show right now. It's redacted.inc/quiz. And today's show is brought to you by our friends at Masa Chips. Hopefully by now, all of you have heard about Masa Chips. These are the incredible chips that only have three ingredients. They have salt, they have corn, and they are made with beef tallow. Yes, they're not filled with any garbage. Masa Chips make you feel satisfied. They're light, they're energetic, with no crash, no bloating. I love their tortilla chips because afterwards you don't feel like you just ate something you shouldn't have. It's the kind of thing that once you try it, you wonder why you ever ate anything else. And because these chips are made with real food, they're far more satiating. So you won't find yourself uncontrollably binging on a bag and still feeling hungry afterwards. Like the other night, we had taco night. I cracked open a bag of the white ones. I love the white ones. Those are my favorite. And I only had like a handful. And I was like, good, I'm full. I'm good. Otherwise, you eat like all those seed oil chips or the garbage stuff, and you eat a whole bag and you feel like, wow, I don't feel satiated at all. And then you feel like garbage. So Masa Chips, totally different. I'm a big fan of them. So right now, if you're ready to give Masa Chips a try, I want you to go out there and check them out. You get 25% off your first order by going to masachips.com/redactednews and use the code redactednews. Ready to give them a try? I want you to go and use that code, 25% off your first order. And one thing to know, because Masa uses real ingredients and makes everything in small batches, certain flavors go out of stock, like kind of naturally. So I just finally got my hands on some of the churro ones. They were out of stock on those. My son loves the churro ones. They're delicious. They were sold out for weeks. Again, that's masachips.com/redactednews. Use the code redactednews for 25% off, or click the link in the video description, or scan the QR code right there on your screen. Can I just ask a stupid question? I mean, we drive by these cell phone towers in 2026, 2027. How exactly was this happening? Was the NSA sort of going out all across the United States, working in tandem with AT&T and Verizon, et cetera? And they knew this?
Yes.
And they were going up to a cell tower? Maybe you could just talk me through that.
This program began primarily, I mentioned earlier, with phone calls, text messages, emails, and then internet, basic internet usage, but on a vast level. And the intent was, wherever the data was, this became the mantra, We just need to get the data. We just need to collect it. That became the obsession. I'll say it was an obsessive compulsive collection disorder. We just need the data. See, because 9/11 happened, it was a failure. We missed it. Missed it. So therefore, in order to ensure we don't miss it again, because there were still concerns about possible follow-up attacks or future attacks, then we just need all the data so we can go back and look at it for patterns. Now, part of that's legit. There's no question about that. If you're talking foreign intelligence, NSA always had blanket authority to collect just about anything overseas as long as it didn't involve U.S. persons. Here, this is the difference. You're now accessing vast amounts of American, U.S. citizen, legal resident, U.S. corporate data, but you're also doing it in partnership with the corporations. So if they, like, I'll give you a couple of examples. If you're talking a telephone company, there's what they call the CDRs. These are basically the data records. They're called data records for when you make a phone call. They had vast access to all of that. And these were special secret orders that were renewed earlier in the early days, every 45 days or so, completely bypassing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act without any warrant. And what was happening is these companies would just turn over the data, literally provide the data directly to NSA. In other cases, NSA was instrumenting international, like where the hubs, talking both wired and wireless, but primarily wired at the time, where they would actually put, this came out later with an AT&T whistleblower, he passed away here recently out in San Francisco, where they were actually they were using an optical splitter. And so what was happening is, this is fiber optics, they were actually had a separate fiber optic that would, when it came in from overseas, it would split off so they could collect it later. And it didn't matter that it was the fact that here's a U.S. end to the communications, we're just going to take it all because, again, we just need it all. That was, again, the mantra was just take it all. That's just a couple of examples. Cell towers, which obviously, because cell technology was becoming increasingly, well, yeah, all those cell towers have records of calls being made or being, transferred back and forth, because in order for a cell phone to make a call, unless they're using satellite, which, another version of that, you can, if you have access through the owner of the cell tower, in this case, the provider of record, which would be a telephone company, they just turn over the records. And so you began this just that, and it became easy. Remember, it's the digital age, so it became very easy to just simply collect the data.
And then what could they actually do with all of that data? They
Well,
didn't
that's
have.
the real bugaboo. As I well know, I remember, and this gets back to my technical background, because I was, again, I was a cryptolinguist, but I was also an intelligence analyst. So it's one thing to collect data. It's one thing to listen in on it. It's another thing to store it. It's a whole another thing to make sense of it. Here you're getting vast amounts of data, and the problem was what they call it, the haystack. How do you find the needle in the haystack? The choice, instead of using the best of American ingenuity and inventiveness, and I became well aware of that technology, I was even part of further developing it and being Fourth Amendment FISA compliant, by the way, but all rejected by NSA. They didn't want any restrictions, any inhibitions. So what was I saying? Sorry, I just lost my train of thought on that.
About actually trying to go through all of this data. I mean, I
Well,
imagine
see,
now with
that became the
AI
problem.
tool. Yeah.
Well, AI, it's actually made the problem in some ways worse and easier, right? Because now AI is being touted as the answer, to skip ahead a few years, as the answer to the what does it all mean problem, right? We have all this data. How do we make sense of it? What I was finding is that analysts, and here again, I'm putting my old analyst hat, but here I am as a senior executive, and I'm going around NSA's campus, and they're getting incredibly frustrated because they're searching across vast amounts of data, and it's taking extremely long amounts of time because of the way they had set it up. Okay. There's just haystacks of data, and now you're asking an analyst to go find the needle in that haystack. The bigger the haystack, the harder it is to find the needle. But here's the kicker, and this was really the central problem that NSA faced, and they knew this. They actually knew this as their challenge problem in the 90s. There was actually studies that said yes, but that meant NSA was going to have to change its approach. Analog era, post-World War II, 50s, 60s, 70s technology, even early 80s, you know, you could get a lot of information from a much smaller set of sources because they were largely analog-based systems and they were basically what they called hard targets. These are targets that you were most interested in, but now you've got internet and there's just this extraordinary amounts of data being broadcast all over the place. So the problem was the bigger the haystack, the harder it is to find the needle. But here's the kicker. This is really the punchline in all of this is what if you're regarding every straw in the haystack as a potential needle? How can you tell the difference?
Every thread is now a possible connection to
that's
something.
Right. And you're mixing it all up. You're not even, this was, again, the very best, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. It's sort of this, the heart and core of sort of America. You know, we have a problem, let's solve it. We have a problem, solve it. Why would we want to not solve it? That problem was actually solved at NSA in the late 90s, early aughts, comprehensively. I mean, I was part of the program. Called Thin Thread, but it was shut down prior to 9/11. It was ready to go well prior to 9/11, but they shut it down because why? They wanted to spend tons and tons of money on another program just to spend a whole lot of money. Now you're getting in the military-industrial complex.
What reminds me of the movie.
Thin Thread was this breakthrough program, one of several, by the way. It wasn't the only one that could parse through vast amounts of data without violating the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that was Fourth Amendment compliant. It would actually encrypt any message of any type. It didn't matter what it was, right? That was actual or probable U.S. person information or data. If it was determined later, and there was even a hot pursuit option where you could actually go after a target, right? Let's say a U.S. person that was engaged in some kind of foreign surveillance activity or providing material support. That was the purpose of FISA, by the way. It wasn't a case of restricting NSA in terms of just foreign intelligence. It had to do with what happens if it involves a U.S. person. This is another distinction is often lost in all the conversations, even over the last 25 years in this. It was never about restricting NSA's ability. I was part of that. I was on the front lines. We used to collect all kinds of stuff in terms of foreign intelligence. But if it involved a U.S. person, there was all these restrictions. So Thin Thread actually provided the means by which you could still parse through. Now, the difference was it didn't also just bring everything back. It didn't just suck the ocean dry, as it were, or as I've used it, illustrate better. You don't have to take all the sand off the beach, spend massive amounts of money with special dump trucks and front end bucket loaders, send it to some filtration system where at the bottom you figure out what you finally have. The problem is you've disturbed the sand, you've removed it from its source. You don't know where it came from, what was washed up, where Thin Thread just left the sand in place and only observed and kept track of the differences. So something foreign showed up or was a potential threat and it involved a U.S. person, you flagged it, tagged it, encrypted it. You would then unencrypt or decrypt through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court because it involved a U.S. person. That was the law of the land. That was all bypassed. But what you unleashed was you've sort of the perverse incentive just to keep collecting it all. Now you have this staggering amount of data and you don't have the burden anymore of whether or not it's a U.S. person. And you're even arguing, well, it's not a true search at all because all we did was collect it. And until we actually look at it, we don't have to worry about whether or not we're violating anybody's rights.
What happened to you after you blew the whistle, personally? What happened to you after you tried to call attention to this through the proper channels?
So it's quite a story in itself. It unfolds over a number of years. So I went through every whistleblower channel that existed. I even my final act of whistleblowing NSA, interestingly enough, was actually with the then NSA director Keith Alexander. He was the follow-on to the previous director Michael V. Hayden, who had come on in '99. So Alexander shows up in late summer of 2005. And it was massive blowback. I ended up losing my job. I was basically what they call laterally arabesqued in the bureaucracy. The message was clearly, the handwriting was on the wall, as it were. And I made a fateful decision, though. In late February of 2006, after having exhausted every whistleblower channel that existed, I exercised my First Amendment rights. Redress of grievances against my own government, even though they're restricted in the government, because of, again, because of the agency that I worked in, which, highly classified, involving a lot of secrets, but it does not prevent you. You still can go to the press. But in this case, I went to the press with unclassified information, but I knew there was a risk, just like what happened at Ellsberg. But in this case, it was unclassified. I actually did go to the press with what I knew regarding not just the warrantless surveillance program, but also just the fact that there was an alternative program called Thin Thread, the fact that there was 9/11 intelligence failures and a massive cover-up, and then just billions and billions in waste, fraud, and abuse. And so in December, and here's the short version, okay, in December of 2005, because you're now wondering, well, okay, December 2005, there's this above the fold traditional print newspaper, above the fold article revealing publicly for the first time, and it was just the tip of the iceberg, the existence of the so-called warrantless wiretapping program. That was an article written by James Risen and Eric Lichtblau. I knew when that article came out that I would be no doubt tagged, targeted as a person of interest. There was even a show for a few years called Person of Interest.
As a
I
source for the
knew
story.
as a source, I knew that. I remember I had not gone to the press yet, contrary to what the government said later. They actually framed me to make it look like I had gone to the New York Times, interestingly enough, prior to that article, because they needed to have a certain narrative, their own narrative, to show that I had actually done that, but I didn't. So I hadn't gotten to the press yet. I knew, though, when that article came out that I was going to be targeted and a few others, because very few people remember, this is over 4 years since the secret surveillance program, which was originally called Stellar Wind. Remember, it was under the president's surveillance program, signed in secret by Bush. NSA became the executive agent for the program. That's the one that, again, unleashed the full power of NSA in cooperation with all the telecommunication concerns and other companies as well, to turn over vast, vast amounts of data. And for NSA, through various other programs, there's like that was just the umbrella program, through other various sub-programs to access all kinds of other data that clearly was going to suck up massive amounts of US person data as well. So I knew, because 2 weeks later, guess what happened? So it's late December, they announced this massive multi-million dollar national security leak investigation. I was tipped off in the spring of 2006. This is after I made anonymous contact with a reporter because I knew I was going to be targeted. That was a given. But in April 2006, one of the other whistleblowers, NSA whistleblowers, who's actually was the Republican staffer on the HPSI, informed myself and my former NSA colleagues. This is like Bill Binney, Kirk Wiebe, Ed Loomis. That she was a target because the original leak investigation figured the leak, and this is sort of a classic knee-jerk response by the executive branch of the government. If there's a leak, you know, it's the executive branch, it's usually the biggest leaker of all historically. Okay. Very self-serving, by the way. It's not a leak, you know. It's not a leak if we're leaking, but it's if it's not us leaking, then it's an unauthorized leak. They assumed initially that the leak had come from Congress. Very few leaks actually come from Congress, interestingly enough. But that's, again, that's another part of the thread here. So I knew that my time was limited, my time was short. So I maintained anonymous contact with a reporter for about a year. But as they were closing in, right, because I knew what they were capable, I mean, it's again, it's a very interesting, how far will the government go to spy on its own citizen if it suspects that it's, you know, revealing state secrets that it doesn't want revealed, especially if they involve the violation of the Constitution of all things and violating the rights of Americans, especially the Fourth Amendment and even the First Amendment. Remember, I'd gone to the press. They consider that a criminal act. To accelerate that forward, Diane Rourke and the other three, my former NSA colleagues, were raided by the FBI about 15 months later. So in July, late July of 2007, unceremoniously visited by the FBI. And I believe I'm the last one that was actually visited, which means they usually reserve who they consider to be the ringleader. And they had actually decided that I was the ringleader. I was engaged in a conspiracy with the others against the United States of America. It's just bizarre for me to even say it that way. All we were doing is upholding the highest and best of America, including the law of the land and the fact that it was all unnecessary, right? The best of America was never, ever put into the fight. And in fact, was suppressed from being put into the fight. So I was visited by the FBI in February, sorry, late November of 2007, a day I'll always remember for the rest of my life. I mean, this is a man's house, is his castle. It's sort of the final defense against government intrusion. They did show up with a warrant, although I actually had to persist in showing them. They had to show me the warrant before they proceeded to actually engage in a full search and seizure of whatever they wanted to find as evidence in my house. And that began the nightmare. There was multiple attempts to get me to plead out to many, many years in prison. I had a criminal defense attorney. I spent many tens and tens of thousands of dollars in my defense. But then it all came to a head in April of 2010. April of 2010, I was unceremoniously indicted under the Espionage Act, 5 counts, obstruction of justice count, as well as four counts of making false statements to the FBI, which were actually false themselves. I was facing 35 years in prison. So just imagine, and it became very public. You can go back, look what the DOJ said, what the FBI said, and others. You know, I was considered an enemy of the state. They clearly had flagged me and tagged me as the ringleader, and they were going to punish me and punish me good. And here I am facing the prospect that pretty much for the rest of my natural life, I could end up in prison. And it was quite a battle, facing 35 years in prison to face it down over a 14-month period. And literally on the eve of trial, I was able to plead out on my terms. They dropped all the 10 counts and I pled out to a minor misdemeanor for what? For exceeding authorized use of a government computer under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act involving no classified information at all.
Have they left you alone since?
Yes, I mean, I went through a probation period, 1 year probation, 240 hours of community service. Interestingly enough, that community service involved, the judge didn't know it at the time. He just sent me to the Army Community Service Director out at Fort Detrick, Frederick, Maryland. And I ended up interviewing about 3.5 dozen veterans from World War II to the present day, including Ellsberg, by the way. Extraordinary interviews with military veterans, up to and including Afghanistan, Iraq, Battle of the Bulge, Vietnam, Korea, Suez Canal period, we were sending troops because we thought World War III was going to break out then, possibly. Just extraordinary. Persian Gulf. It's all out there at the Veterans History Project. Some extraordinary interviews. It's all oral. They're primarily oral, but I videotape them. And some of them go on for hours. Some are shorter, some are longer. And yeah, they left me alone. I paid a huge price. Remember, my career was completely upended. I gave up, to say it, this couple of million dollars in retirement benefits. I had spent, I had over 15 at this point, going on 20 plus years of total service. I only need a few more years, about 5 to 8 years or so, to get a full retirement from the government. I gave all that up. I lost it all. There's no pension at all. I have a very small annuity just because of the time I had served as a senior executive. So yeah, I paid an extraordinarily heavy price, and I didn't even talk about the personal cost or the health challenges I went through later. Because extraordinary pressure. I mean, you got the full weight of the government on top of you, and they're hell bent to put you in prison. I don't, it's Kafkaesque. I don't know how else to. I mean, it's quite an ordeal at a very personal level. Your profession, you blow up your career. I was, the height of my career, earning potential and all that. Gave all that up for what? Because I would not break fidelity with the oath I had taken. Remember, that oath is an oath to the Constitution. It's to support and defend the Constitution against who? All enemies, foreign and domestic. And here I am finding myself defending the law of the land, the Constitution, against my own government because the government's decided to violate it on purpose, willfully,
Edward
with
Snowden.
acts. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Go ahead.
Edward Snowden famously said there would be no Edward Snowden without Thomas Drake, that you had gone through all of the proper channels,
Yeah.
brought it to the IG, brought it to Congress. And of course, rather than protecting you against retaliation, as he said, they retaliated against you in the most public and aggressive way possible. And he has said that without you, there would be no Edward Snowden. So he saw your example of
Yeah.
going through the proper channels to try to get this out to the American people, and that failed. And so he went a different way. I'm curious that relationship, and when you heard about what Edward Snowden had done, where was that in your timeline?
Well, I was actually coming back from a conference in New York City when the news broke in June of 2013, that it was Edward Snowden. And I was not surprised. I did not know him. Some people thought I knew him because he had been at NSA. I didn't, but I was not surprised. I had always hoped that someone at great risk would come along later. Remember, I was at the epigenesis of the mass surveillance regime post 9/11.
Yeah, you were
And
there as it was beginning, really in earnest.
the foundation of it, but it quickly expanded. But by the time we get to Snowden, and this is even, several years after I was indicted. You're talking now 3 years after I was indicted, ostensibly because I had revealed the secret surveillance program to the New York Times. Remember, that was the original basis. If you go back to the affidavit, which I was not able to get during the course of my pretrial proceedings, interestingly enough, the government covered that up, even though they had been ordered by the court to release it to in the public interest. They realized that it was going to expose how they had framed me. So they did all kinds of shenanigans not to give it to my own public defenders. So this is 3 years later, we have now the Snowden disclosures. I had always hoped someone like Snowden would come along. Why? To reveal, but obviously at great risk, the full metastasization of the mass surveillance regime that had been put into place post 9/11.
One of the ways that I've been able to transform how I invest is by buying precious metals. And of course, we are facing right now, which could be a major gold reevaluation. Again, I spoke to Brian Solarchuk, who's a mining legend, a gold mining legend, a few weeks ago here on the show, and he told me He believes gold is heading to $10,000 an ounce. Now, the gold that's currently sitting in Fort Knox, if it's there at all, is currently valued at about $40. Like, that's how the government values the gold that's on hand inside the government stockpiles, which is crazy. So the Trump administration has been toying with the idea of revaluations of gold to the current market standards or even higher. So if gold right now is trading over $4,000 an ounce, what do you think is going to happen if suddenly the federal government says, yes, the gold we have on hand is actually worth $7,000 an ounce? It completely changes everything. All that to say, there is a real demand for physical precious metals, silver and gold right now. Real assets. Real assets. Heck, the Bank of International Settlements, when it was dealing with the Nazi government during World War II, they didn't want paper currency, all that fake Reichsmark and paper currency that was worthless as the U.S. dollar continues to become more and more worthless. What do they want? They wanted gold. That's how they were able to settle transactions, through gold. So that's why it's a huge part of our portfolio in addition to real estate. And I want you to work with our friends at Lear Capital. They're fantastic. They're an American company, and they will help you from soup to nuts. Learn the situation. You know, if you're totally new to the process of working on buying precious metals, they will get on the phone with you and have a great conversation with you and take you through the entire process. So what I want you to do is just go to LearRedacted.com. That's the website. Or even better, just get on the phone with them. Have a conversation with them. They can help you figure out where you are in your investing journey right now. And their phone number is 800-613-3557. 1-800-613-3557. Or once again, go to LearRedacted.com to learn more. We can, you know, it's just remarkable to think about that time in American history. You talked about the pre-9/11 life that we lived, the post-9/11 life that we lived. And of course, flash forward to today and where we are. Do you think humanity is sleepwalking into a future, or are we currently here where privacy disappears before people even understand what privacy even meant? Like, children growing up to know or have an idea of what you labeled earlier, Benjamin Franklin's discussions about freedom and surveillance. Do you think that we've just totally sleepwalked into a total surveillance state?
Yes. Some call it soft tyranny, that the mechanism by which you have turnkey tyranny, as others have shared, or sort of something, inverted democracy, where, see, this gets into sort of the heart and core of power and control. Henry Kissinger actually had something to say about that. He said power was the greatest aphrodisiac, and it probably said more about Kissinger than anything else, but also had something to say about power. It's incredibly seductive to hold power of any kind, direct or indirect, over another human being. And we have too many examples in terms of the sad litany of human history across the millennia, example after example after example. Are you really truly free? Are you? See, this is now what I call privacide, meaning what's happened, and this is the perversion really, is the data commoditization, as I call it, and it's something I confronted. And I was a technologist for a number of years. I did a lot of consulting in Silicon Valley. But after I went free, or I should say stayed free, right? I was at a conference. It was a Web 2.0 summit out in the Palace Hotel in downtown San Francisco. This is the fall of 2011. And I actually held up the mirror to the Twitters of the world, the Microsofts of the world. I held up a mirror to all of them. I said, "What are you doing? You know, you're enticing people, and it's true, with terms and conditions, free services, but then you get to take all that data and commoditize it and then sell it back to your subscribers. And what do you give up?" Remember, this is where you get into the third party doctrine. It is sort of the heart of all this. It's you don't own that. It's you're consenting to any and all data that you provide, share. It's not yours. It's someone else's. You're already seeing that, by the way. You've seen that, like with electronic books, where they can literally turn off your, you know, just because you bought it. Even if you bought it, if you really look at the terms and conditions, they can revoke those. Most of them can be revoked at any time.
Yeah, the same with all sorts of media. It's all,
yes,
you're buying a license, like
buying a license or buying a subscription,
right? Yeah, you don't actually own the material.
That's correct. And this is the hook. This is the hook. But beyond all that, let's like what is possible when you have the flock cameras, which are now being increasingly showing up in all kinds of neighborhoods. A lot of pushback, by the way.
Tens of thousands of cameras now all over the United States. People think, oh, that's just happening in the UK or London. There's a new website that just emerged over the past few days. I don't know if it's called like dflock.org. We'll put it in the description box and we have the correct URL, but it shows all of the cameras across the United States. And there are many, I think there might be 46 cities now that are banning these flocking cameras. But it's not enough. I mean, there's 10,000 of them and growing at a rapid pace. What are these flocking cameras doing?
Keeping track of us based on our signatures. The kicker with some of the newer flock, I don't know if you've been reading about it. I've been trying to keep up as much as I can. It's very challenging even for me to keep up, even as a former technologist in this space, just how far surveillance has gone. Where not only is it just a mirrors, we have traffic cameras, right? Well, this goes way beyond that. It's actually picking up the signatures of any electronic devices linked to you, vehicle, your devices. Bluetooth, by the way, broadcasts all kind, broadcasts a sort of a constant signal. It's very easy then to start correlating who you are, not just based on the car's license plate, but the car's signature. And a lot of these cars, as I well know, they actually have a module inside the car that transmits data pretty much all the time and lets you turn it off. What about all that data that's being collected?
Who's gathering this data? So when they're tracking your phone, they're tracking your car as you drive through this one street.
Yes.
It's grabbing that information about you or me.
Yep.
Where does it go?
It goes into these massive databases, and this is the back door. I got to go right to the point here in terms of government access. It's one thing for a private corporation to have it. That's one thing. But how do they make money? How do they make money off of that? Yeah, they sell this to like municipalities and others, and just set them on telephone poles and other prominent locations or less prominent locations, right? Some are actually masked. The government, this is the third party doctrine because it's not considered to be your data. So they get broad access through various means, some through secret programs, backdoor, some through now, if they're actually going after somebody through national security letters or the equivalent. This is something way less than a warrant because it's considered to be third party doctrine data, which means it's not yours. So you have no reasonable expectation of protection, or let alone privacy, of that data because it's quote unquote owned by someone else. In this case, you're not even consenting. I mean, this is even in, like, I have an EV, by the way. I can, which I do right now, I actually have in my car, I have it turned off right now, the communications module that's nearly in constant through the cloud with the manufacturer and their cloud service. So, but just because I have that turned off, I drive down the road. I don't have to go too far, even where I live in the United States, where a flock camera or another version of it easily can pick up my license plate. Well, the license plate is in the open now, isn't it? Guess what? They can link to the license plate. Now add on top of that, all of the surveillance equipment that picks up any and all signals coming from the car, including phones, because the phone is by definition a tracking device, unless you have it completely turned off or remove the battery, like you can't remove the battery anymore. They track that as well through its cell tower network. So you're just correlating massive amounts of data. It only takes.
I was going to say, you can turn off that transponder. You can try to turn off Bluetooth on your phone.
You can.
Of course, then your phone can't really communicate with your car.
That's right.
You can't unlock your EV without your Bluetooth. And then Then you're driving through a flock camera or a transponder for the toll booth.
Yep.
So
what if they don't like you? I'm gonna cut right to the chase.
Right. That's a great point. Everyone, this has all happened to everyone, but now they want to come after Thomas Drake.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And they can even pattern, they can map out if you happen to be associated, you had to be near somebody that they don't like, or you might be like guilty by association, even if it's the metadata. Guess what? You make a social media post they don't like, they show up at your house. That's actually happening now. So you're talking about an extraordinary ability to begin to start suppressing First Amendment protected speech, freedom of movement, and I'm just going to say it, autonomy. What happens to your autonomy in all of this?
Right. You took the words right out of my mouth, because I was about to ask you, you know, at what point does surveillance stop being about watching behavior?
Yes.
And start becoming a system for shaping that behavior?
Well, think about this thing that they're trying to push through Congress right now, the so-called Kitty Act. Mm-hmm. This is sort of a pattern on what's been going on in the UK and others, but particularly the UK, under the guise of protecting children. You have to prove your identity when you're
sign in on the internet. Exactly. It's all about safety of children, right?
Yeah. Now, that's legit, safety of children. That's legit. It is. Sure. But guess what? It also provides. Now, you know, it has to identify. What about what happens if you're a source for a journalist reporting something hypersensitive regarding, you know, a government corruption? What happens in anonymity if you're a source? Do you have to go back to the Watergate days to meet in a garage? The problem is the underground garage has surveillance cameras.
Right. Yeah.
And you have facial recognition as well.
Leave a potted plant out on your, I want to talk to you. So let's leave a potted plant on your stoop. And then I'll come and we'll meet in a dark garage in the middle of the night.
Deep but if you're style. Tracking, yeah, but see, the even, but see, you can now track the actual person based on their signature. Where do you go?
Can I you mean, describe this is, their this signature. Is the signature because of your Bluetooth? Is it because of your phone? Or is it even all because of what President Trump talked about with the 6G technology? It's even your physical body being tracked?
Yes. They've already demonstrated, I'm aware of this from previous work I did, this is early on, where Wi-Fi actually creates patterns that allow for detection of movement from point A to point B within buildings.
But far more powerful is 6G?
Oh, way more powerful in terms of accuracy, yes. I mean, it's just, you're now, see, part of this is the accuracy. Remember, even cell phone technology, older style, right, by itself can get you, depending on where you are, right, maybe a third of a mile, a quarter of a mile at best. You know, that's pretty close, isn't it? Right, you get you within a couple of neighborhoods, but then you start triangulating with other things, and now you just put it right there on top of you within a few feet. I mean, this is, and if they don't like you, remember, you got drone technology, you've got, you know, these micro, basically assassination bots, right, built in, that they can just, based on a signature, can send the drone right to you. What? How do you protect yourself against that? So what happens? See, what's the effect on people? People begin to censor themselves. This is probably one of the biggest things that I'm concerned about that's starting to happen. People will just be reluctant to speak out about anything because of the fear that it might be controversial, that it might, you already see on social media, I don't like what you said, I'm gonna find out a way, in some cases, disable your account.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're seeing this.
Now, throw AI on top of that. AI is amoral, aethical. right?
We're seeing these people who say, I managed to get these accounts banned for speaking out against me. You know, and they or they go to YouTube, whatever they do, they go to YouTube, they go to X. I saw somebody the other day saying, I managed to get these accounts taken down and banned because they said something critical of me. Like, that's where we're
at. This is the environment, this incredibly chilling atmosphere that we're now entering into on a far greater scale. I mean, this reminds me of George Orwell. I mean, we're going back as his last book, right? Is a few months before he passed away, as he finished writing it. I mean, Winston, I just remember him sitting in the corner because it was the only place where the surveillance cameras couldn't see him, but that meant they knew where he was.
So maybe you can talk about what's happening on the debanking side as well. So you hear it from, you know, some high profile individuals, maybe commentators on television, on the new, you know, on the internet, who've been debanked. I was sitting next to a journalist one day in Europe who was covering the truth about the Ukraine war. And I was in the middle of an interview with him, and he looked down and he got an alert that his bank had shut him down for his coverage of the Ukraine war. Great reporter, by the way, great journalist. So we hear about it from journalism, but what about debanking of average Americans just based on their behavior?
You come to the attention of somebody, and that's increasingly can be just about anybody. And they decide they want to censor you. And if they want to make it more permanent, especially in today's world, if you basically turn off your bank account, what does that do? Just think about it. I mean, I went electronic many, many years ago. Last time I wrote a check. I mean, I actually had to write a couple of checks recently. It was kind of weird writing the check. And I realized even that's electronic. What happens if they decide to prevent you from engaging in commerce as a private citizen or even as a commercial concern or as a company because someone doesn't like you, your speech, your product, or your presence on social media? They can literally extinguish you. And then what is your recourse? I'm aware of some stories out there regarding how difficult it is to reestablish yourself because that also follows you. Or if you make a number of electronic transfers, you know, monetary transfers that come close to or exceed a certain limit, and that's in the United States, it's usually the $10,000, that can automatically flag you. Completely innocent, legitimate, but it's automatically, see, this is where everything becomes suspicious or everything can be made suspicious. And then on top of that, the government can purchase. I mean, this is where you get into the autonomy gap. What's the effect on personal agency and your individual rights? Governments can purchase location history without a warrant. They can query your private communications without judicial oversight. They can scan your face in public places without your knowledge. They can pick up any and all electronic signatures. So your practical ability going forward, even when you're exercising your right to move, your right to speak, your right to associate and dissent, structurally becomes increasingly diminished because even those acts of agency are tracked and mapped and patterns are established. Even if there's never an arrest made and it's kept permanently. That's one reason why, by the way, Snowden, if you read his book, Permanent Record, that's really the basis for, some people wonder, why did you call it Permanent Record? Because none of this goes away. I mean, I remember the almost $2 billion that were spent by NSA to build a Utah data center out at Fort Williams in Utah. Massive complex with the ability to expand. And people are saying, why would they build such a huge facility? This is like, you could say this is the OG of data centers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's to store everything.
It's not just metadata, it's everything. Everything. Because you never know. I mean, it's,
I'm
just never
reminded
does.
of
Remembers the Minority Report, right? You never know when you might need it.
Well, and it's also this idea, like in Batman, you know, The Dark Knight Rises, when Anne Hathaway's Catwoman character is trying to get the clean slate, right? So she's trying to make a deal so she can have a clean slate, and these guys are going to wipe her from the internet, from her past crimes, et cetera. And they laugh
I
at her.
I actually knew. You want to get another example? Yeah, well, past crimes. Remember what Stalin said, show me the man, I'll show you the crime. Or just because, yeah, you've.
We'll manufacture something.
Well, manufacturer. I remember a technologist who ended up on a watch list. He ended up on a watch list. Why? Because there was a mistake that was made in terms of his name. And he showed, this was years ago. This is early on, post 9/11. And it's just in the years right after 9/11. And it came up, it was at a technology conference when I was still on the circuit, as it were. And it came up, and he was flagged and put aside for additional screening because it was assumed that he was a terrorist. He was actually on one of the early terrorist watch lists. How do you get off of it? You know the machinations he went through just to get off the watch list? Because he's once on the watch list.
And how would you know? I mean, you have people like Tulsi Gabbard who were on these watch lists. You had people like, remember Senator Ted Kennedy was on the watch list. Senator of the United States on a watch list. How do you, and they're lucky enough to find out about it, but how many Americans are on these lists that don't even know about it?
You don't. That's part of it. And they're obviously controlled. How do you know? You don't. You just never know. I mean, this is where now it's like, but think about the chilling effect.
For a lot of Americans, they don't know that they're, I guess, going to be debanked or they're going to be shadow banned, right? So you have these terms emerging over the past few years, shadow banning, where someone feels like they're suddenly marginalized, they're pushed to the side, you know, and it almost sounds like, oh, you're just being cynical, you're just being paranoid. No. You know,
Not at all.
you talk about that?
No, because part of the problem here, and this is part of the, this is where the fear factor comes in. Fear in itself is a control mechanism. So you just, I can sort of summarize, maybe I would just say summarize it. There are secret lists, secret rules, no recourse. So that's kind of the fundamental challenge if you're the person. How do you challenge that? Because once the information enters into government hands by hook or by crook, it's retained indefinitely. The rules governing its use can be changed in secret without any kind of public notice. And here's the kicker: if you're on a if there's wa a watch list, like inclusion on the watch list, there's no meaningful notice that you're even on this list, no stated reason. And there is no, as I mentioned earlier, there's no effective way you can even challenge it.
When, if the government.
It's all national security. And then you put this huge umbrella over it, national security. We're providing public safety. We're
I mean, if the.
protecting, yeah.
Yeah. If they won't always spin it as safety, of course. If the government can know nearly everything about the people and. But the people know less and less about the government, like, is democracy still real?
No. Name only. This is where, to me, democracy is being basically we're de-democratizing. You want to say it that way? I only have ever used
Yeah.
that phrase before. De-democratizing our own country because it's a threat. Democracy in itself becomes a threat to power. That's incredibly chilling.
Do you think we're at a period now, or do you think maybe future generations will look back on this period right now, maybe the post 9/11 period, the period that you went through and the period we're currently in, and say, you know, this is when humanity gave away its inner life, its inner privacy,
Oh,
its inner
wow, that's
meaning.
a. See, now you're sort of at the heart of what it means to be a human. What does it mean to associate? What does it mean to relate to one another? What does it mean to live? What does it mean to be in a relationship with others, both close, intimate, as well as extended family and friends, and your social connections? What does that mean? You increasingly are seeing a fragmented society. And then I think psychologically that causes its own long-term effects on sort of the health and well-being of society at large. And then you have those with massive amounts of money, just staggering amounts, who don't really care about the general welfare of anybody else, only about themselves, and are increasingly isolating even themselves from society because they can. And so I mean, this is where, and then if you look like you're out of line for any reason, this is what some call algorithmic discrimination that's occurring, predictive surveillance. This is where you get back to the Minority Report. This becomes, in essence, you increasingly create a pre-crime society. Everybody can commit a crime. And who's going to define it, right? Whoever's in power. And now it's like rule of law. It's not rule of law anymore. It's just rule. And I get to decide what the rules are, and I can make them up and change them on the fly. So because I'm in power.
Right. And I can tell you that you can't post online. I can come to your house in under the darkness of night because of your social media post. You're debanked. You no longer have the ability to participate in society. No way really to live functionally without this new digital ID, this new or being able to make any sort of payments because I've deemed it you're a risk in some way.
That means you effectively become excommunicated from society, and then you're living on the margins at best.
Do you think privacy, when you think about privacy, you know, is it a legal right or is
yes.
it a...
Well, it's more than legal. Legal, see, actually, to me, it's a fundamental inalienable right. I go back to the Declaration of Independence.
Right. I mean, is it a sacred space?
Yes.
Like, do you think the founders saw it as a sacred space where our conscience, like, and that's, of course, I've spoken to CIA whistleblowers who've told me the ultimate goal from the CIA is to have that connection to our consciousness, to know exactly what we're doing, not just our physical movement in a physical space, flocking cameras, but to have control of our consciousness. And that's really the ultimate goal of the CIA through all of their mechanisms and tools. That's really at the heart of it and why they're so enamored with this idea of merging AI with our persons so that, you know, we don't have that sacred space anymore. We don't have the ability to dissent. We don't really have creativity because now we've outsourced that as well. And then we don't have a soul because if you've invaded our sacred space, you've invaded our consciousness.
You're striking at the heart of something that I'm increasingly focused on is what does this mean for humanity long-term? When you put in this sort of the control regime in place, that's really what it is. It's a control regime. What does that do to people long-term? Because to me, ultimately, it's anti-life and anti-human. That's what we're giving up. And for as long as I'm alive, I'm going to continue to defend and support life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, because that's central to what it means to even be a human being. It's the being part of human being that's really what we're losing.
How do we fight back?
Well, I could be somewhat flippant and say we have to keep being a human being. We just have to keep being. So, but that does mean there are risks. There's risk to be yourself, you know, and still continue to express yourself despite all the attempts to control it and privacide it, to say it that way. But that's what's at risk. The heart and core of what it means to be a human being is really what is at stake here. And see, that's what I keep, even in my more formal presentations, one of the core questions I will ultimately come to in various ways, depending on the fora and the audience, is what future do we want to keep? It's a fundamental question. And because in all of this, it comes back to who we are as we the people, and that even extends globally, because democracy is in retreat right now. There's no question. And there's been some, you know, some pushback, and Hungary is a good example of that. I have to say that, where people were just so fed up, right? That they decided, you know what, we've got to reclaim at least some part of our own agency. So they were able to do that. It's very difficult in the end, especially when you're really, really squeezed and you have nothing left to give, when you basically have no F's to give. What do you do, right? What do you do? So if you have nothing to lose, because I've been asked that myself, I said, well, it wasn't just for me, it was for everybody else, right? What happens if we lose, if we don't take a stand here, then when? If not me, then who? I mean, this is where it's sort of the fundamental questions. You know, it's at the core of our personhood, right? It's at the core of our identity. How dare anybody sit there and define what that is, or define what I can or can't do based on a definition that the state imposes? That was one of the main reasons, even though it was a protected class, but it extended to everybody, although it had restrictions, when we declared independence from the crown, you know, 250 years ago with the Declaration of Independence. To me, it's one of the most extraordinary documents in human history.
And I'm worried that if we were to do it all again, I've said this publicly, I mean, Bill of Rights, there wouldn't be a First Amendment. I mean, there would not be freedom of speech. That would be actively trying to remove that. That would be probably any future constitution, if you were to tear it all down and restart it, which a lot of people have been calling for revolution, there wouldn't be freedom of speech. I find it very difficult to believe that those in power would allow that to happen again, and maybe the Fourth Amendment as well. I think, you know,
I would argue the first 10 amendments, which remember came 2 years later. And by the way, anything that was not delineated in the Constitution, you know, goes to the, you know, to the states and to the people. So it's those first 10, and I could argue, though, that what's the foundation of all of that is the First Amendment. But if you don't have the Fourth Amendment, then what does that mean? Because the Fourth Amendment, in some ways, I experienced directly was violating that, because it was weaponized against me, was to punish me for speech, was to punish me from association. It was to punish me from speaking out. It was to punish me as a whistleblower. It was to punish me to, how dare you hold up a mirror to power, but in this case, the abuse of power. How dare you? So you're going to pay the price because you're exposing the abuse of power, but we're in power. This is sort of the Joseph Heller in the Catch-22 novel.
Yeah.
Where the colonel is, Colonel Cathcart, is like, who's going to stop us now? We have the power. And that's in part where power, you know, is it a permanent condition? No, I don't think it actually is. I don't think that but it can cause huge wreckage on many, many lives before, you know, it disappears. And there is this tendency, again, look at the dustbins of history and all the mechanisms for the millennia that have been used to impose control on other human beings for the sake of power. And if you decide to go up against power, we can, and you know, up to and including extinguishing you, getting rid of you. But see, now you're going full circle back to the surveillance state. We don't actually have to get rid of you in sort of the classic way, old school, go out and shoot you. We'll debank you. We'll desocialize you. We'll cut you off from your connections. And then what? You're basically rendered powerless, because if you don't have a voice, guess what?
Yeah, you're impotent.
But only power has a voice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're impotent. And then, you know, move everyone to a universal basic income and have everyone under constant surveillance, know your consciousness, know your movements, know everything that you do. And that's really the ultimate goal. And they've been very public about it, and it's deeply troubling.
Deeply troubling. It's wide open. There's no pretense here anymore. Wide open. You're also this data, by the way, just I find it just incredibly dystopian. The data broker loophole. Remember, I mentioned the third party doctrine, but the data broker loophole, federal agencies, ICE, FBI, they routinely purchase all this data, by the way, or have these special arrangements. Remember, these companies aren't doing it for free. They're not. It's actually a business decision for them. They get to make a lot of money from the central government by turning over the subscriber records. And courts have not yet adjudicated fully this practice. It's an untested, it still is a largely untested legal gray area. You did see the recent case with the geofencing. The Supreme Court is a fairly narrow decision, but it does, in fact, to their credit, in terms of the majority opinion, does acknowledge that it's a search. So that's, you know, that at least getting back to some semblance, at least with respect to geofencing.
Well, there's a bright light. Before I let you go, Thomas, I mean, have you talked to Edward Snowden in the recent few years? Have you had communications with him? Have you ever commiserated about where you see things going?
Last time I spoke to him was actually when we went directly. Last time I spoke to him directly was, there's been social media posts, but that's indirect, obviously, because it's public. And he hasn't been on social media for quite a while now, going back about a year and a half. But last time I actually spoke to him was face-to-face, interestingly enough, directly. There's been other places where he came in remotely, right? And where I was in the audience. But in the last time I spoke to him directly was when we went to Moscow to present him with the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. And so there was several of us as whistleblowers went there as activists, and I included myself, Colleen Rowley, Ray McGovern, Justin Radak. Daniel Ellsberg was going to be on that trip as well, by the way. But he was having some health challenges at the time, so the doctor was very reluctant to have him travel, you know, that far. So we spent a number of hours with him. It's surreal when I think about it. That was because back there was a time during the Cold War, the last place you would find yourself was Moscow.
Moscow, two NSA whistleblowers, you know.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable. And there's been some accounts that are written of that meeting. But it was sort of a meeting of history, as it were. You know, there I was at the epigenesis, and there he was, 2013. You know, under circumstances that he did not want to live. He never wanted to live in Russia. You know, he was on his way to Ecuador. And of course, the United States saw fit to revoke his passport, which, as I well know, my passport was revoked. I had to actually file. I had to go back to the court to actually have them return my passport, because when I was arraigned, the government said I was a flight risk. In fact, they wanted to put an ankle bracelet on me, but they also moved to revoke my passport, so I couldn't go outside the country, and I had to have special permission to travel. You talk about restrictions. I had to have special permission to even travel within the United States outside of the local area.
Jeez.
Yeah. I know what it's like. See, we mentioned all of this in terms of what does it mean to live in a surveil. I've already lived that. I know what it's like to be electronic surveil. I know what it's like to be physically tracked, physically observed for years. I don't want anybody else to live that way. I mean, we're getting to the point now that we don't trust anybody. I don't dare stick my head out the window. I mean, you are getting to the point where people are don't even like aren't even willing to open their door because you just don't know. And I understand there is, there are really people that show up that have other intentions in mind.
But it's always been that way. I mean, go back to the 1980s,
Yeah.
but we had a revolving door in our front of our house and kids in and out running through the neighborhood and all of that. And I feel like, we've lost that innocence in a way, and it's incredibly regrettable. But I
I remember as
hope.
a kid, I'm a little older. I mean, I'm pushing 70. I look back, growing up as a kid in Texas and Vermont, and you take your bike out or your roller skates, and it was a level of freedom that I'm only now beginning to fully appreciate what that meant. We weren't latchkey kids. The biggest trouble I got in was climbing the fence, and it turns out that the neighbor had these prize rose
Oh no.
flower, and I picked a bud to bring back to my mom because I was a little kid. It was this pretty flower. Next thing I know, the neighbor, they're knocking on the door. What happened?
Oh my
That was
gosh.
my introduction to private property, which it was.
Oh, the sanctity of all of that seems like it's a bygone era. Well, Thomas, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And when we had you on before, I said, I really want to hear your story and what you see for the United States of America right now under this surveillance state. So I hope this is a cautionary tale for people, and I hope that people wake up. And at the heart of it, as you said, just be human. And if we continue to be human, that's a fight enough. And hopefully we can all stand up and say enough is enough. I hope that's the case. I hope that's the case. Thomas, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Yeah, thanks for having me back.